So most of you have listened to my YouTube talks, and there's well over 1,000 of those talks available. I'm sure you've heard me talk about every subject there could be. Some of those subjects are very interesting subjects of great value in our modern world, such as my talk on Buddhism and bananas, and Buddhism and coffins. But Bante asked me to talk about something which is useful to you. And part of my job is actually to make these Buddhist teachings applicable to everybody in this world and to address problems which we have in our modern world. And so let's get a very serious problem and with a bit of humor as well, because if I get too serious, people fall asleep. In fact, when I first became a Buddhist, it was in England, in London, and I used to go to the temples and listen to the Bantes giving talks, and because I was a student, a very busy life, I fell asleep in the temples when the Bantes were giving the talks. And because of that experience, I remember that now I make sure that I don't send anyone else to sleep. Having been on the receiving end of boring talks, I will not do that on anybody else. So the subject which just came to mind just after Bante introduced me was actually the Buddhism and terrorism. Now ISIS, Islamic terrorism in our modern world. And how, as a Buddhist, can we contribute to a solution to a problem which is affecting everybody today? It even affects me. Every time I go to the airport, now you have to be scanned. I don't know what they see under my robes. Maybe it's because they think there's a bit fat in here. Maybe the monk is wearing a suicide belt. But it is a modern problem and something we should understand. And the first thing is actually to put this problem in perspective. Now there's an old simile, which I'm sure you've seen on YouTube, which now psychologists are using and charging people a lot for. It is my old simile of how big a hand is. Now I invented this simile a long time ago, and I use it very often. How big is a hand? My hand is now so big, I can't see any of you, I can't see Bante, I can't see the Wihara, I can't see anything. All I can see is my own hand. And is it the problem my hand is too big? Or is it a problem because of perspective? And of course, as soon as I put my hand out here, my hand hasn't changed its size, but because I have perspective now, I'm putting it where it belongs, at the end of my arm. I can see my hand, but I can also see everything else as well. Now that is a problem, that is a little simile which psychologists are using, because I was at a conference in Singapore a couple of years ago, and one of the presenters was actually showing some videos of modern psychologists. And this fellow was using my method, making a lot of money out of it, and not giving any cut to the temple. But never mind. The main thing was he was helping people. So this is terrorism. Now, when we put it right in front of us, then when we've got no perspective, we think the world is ending, this is terrible, and it's the only thing we really look at. But when we put it in perspective, we can find all sorts of other solutions and all other ways of dealing with a problem like that. And one of those ways of dealing with a problem like that, putting it in perspective. I said I was born in London in 1951. And of course, my parents were Londoners. So they had to be in London during the Second World War. And during that Second World War, it wasn't one bomb going off. It was thousands of bombs going off every night for months at a time. My grandfather, my maternal grandfather, he was a fire warden when he was out looking after other people one evening during one of the raids. The house next door to my mother got blown up, got a direct hit from a bomb. Now, the houses are not like you have in the United States with a big distance between houses. These were houses which shared a common wall. So it was literally the other side of the wall where the neighbors. They got a direct hit. They were immediately killed. And of course, the house where my, or the apartment, the terraced house where my mother and grandmother were, was totally obliterated. My mother escaped with slashes, so with lacerations to her arm, with lots and lots of cuts. My grandmother also managed to survive. If the bomb was a little bit to the other side, I would not be here today. Now, people in the United Kingdom at the time, they had a beautiful attitude, you know, to what now we would call incredible terrorism. Bombs going off everywhere. Now, you can't blame the German people because the Brits did just as bad to Germany at the same time. But it was one thing which people learned to cope with. A wonderful thing which I learned from my parents and from other people at that time, they had this beautiful attitude towards life and death. They always used to say, you know, when my number comes up, then I will die. It's almost an understanding about the law of karma. But the fact is they accepted, you know, the fact of life and the fact of death. Our problem is these days, is death is such a hidden subject that no one dies these days. They pass away. They go to the other side. They go and meet Uncle George in heaven to live happily ever after, but no one dies these days. Which is one of the reasons why we cannot accept this life and death. And why when somebody does get killed, we call it like terrorism. And because of that, we have a wrong perspective with this problem. We can very easily overreact. My parents would tell stories about, you know, the Blitz and Second World War. And so, that one wonderful thing happened is everybody valued one another, they looked after one another, there was harmony between people, that people would not argue with one another or have these terrible splits, you know, in their community, simply because they didn't know where they're going to live tomorrow. And death, the shortage of life, was so obvious to them, because people next door got killed, their friends got killed by bombs. It was such, as they say these days, in your face, that it had this beautiful side effect, that people forgave one another, and they cared for one another, as they saw every day that life was short. And unfortunately, these days, we forget how short life is. And to make the point, I usually do a quick count of people here. Well, there's maybe about 40 people here, maybe 50 people here today. And a quick stats means, yeah, about one of you will be dead this time next year. It's just probability, statistics. One of you will be dead this time next year. Now, don't just look at the old people. That could be you. And of course, that's true. That's statistics. That's probability. So are you ready? Are you ready to go? One great advantage of terrorism is that we get prepared. So when we get prepared on how to die, death is not a bad thing. In fact, people who know what happens when you die know it's a very beautiful experience. Dying is the terrible part, but actually once you're dead, once you get it over with, it's beautiful, it's wonderful. And to make the point, there's one video which somebody showed me from the BBC, where they were interviewing people who claimed to have these near-death experiences called NDEs. And experiences when you have an accident or a heart attack, and you said you float outside of your body, you can see everything going on, and then you go towards the light and stuff like that. I'm sure you've seen videos or you've heard experiences or read books where people claim to have those experiences, and maybe some of you have had that experience yourself. But there was one woman who had so-called died on the operating table, and she floated up outside of her body, and according to the video, she was so happy to be out of her body, which had been sick for months, for years, and now she was free of her old, painful body, which would not do what she asked it to do. That's one of the problems when you get old. Now, when you are young, you are born without teeth, without hair, wearing nappies. And that's what you end up with when you get old as well. No teeth, no hair, and wearing nappies. But when she died, she felt so free of all of this. And she said on interview with the BBC that she went floating up outside of her body, and she met what she called like a spirit, another being, who came up to her and told her, "It is not your time. You have to go back to your body." And she said, "No way." "But you must." "But I don't want to." "But you have to go back." "I won't." And they had this great argument on the psychic plane, or whatever you call it. And the argument was only settled, she said, obviously she did come back, that's why she could tell us, it only got settled when this being took hold of her astral body, whatever it is, took hold of it and threw it back into this body on the operating table. And she came alive again. And in the interview, that's where she screwed up her face with so much anger. And she said, "When I die next time, when I really die, the first thing I'm going to do is find that guy." And you wouldn't believe what I'm going to do to him. All his plans of what he did to me is unforgivable. Now, I tell that story at funerals. The funerals can be really depressing and stuff like that. So, tell the story because it's a very good example of a person who's experienced death who realises it's not that bad. It's actually quite nice once you get past that point of dying. It's something even to look forward to. Just like, for example, now, if most religions, even like Buddhism, you believe that good people go to good places, like heaven realms and stuff like that. Christians believe that as well. Most religions believe you go to good realms. So why are people afraid of dying? Just imagine. Just imagine. In these series of talks, the organizers, Dhammadharini, together with ABS Temple, we give you a special prize. And the prize is one of you will be selected for the prize. And the prize is a first class airline ticket to, what's a very nice resort? Say, Bermuda, Bahamas, where would you like to go? That's Sri Lanka, you go there all the time.
Hawaii.
Yeah, that's Hawaii, that's a good one. A first class ticket from United Airlines to Hawaii for you and a partner. Staying not in a 5-star hotel, a 6-star hotel.
Ooh.
Okay, and with $1,000 each to spend every day for a fortnight for your special prize. Would you like that?
Yes.
Very good. And suppose, just suppose, you're not going to get it, but just suppose. Suppose you won it today. And you're going to go off to Hawaii in 2 weeks' time. Would you be excited?
Yes.
When it gets to 1 week, would you be thinking, only 1 week to go?
Yes.
The night before, would you all be packed, ready to go?
Yeah.
Would you hardly yet be able to sleep the night before? Are you going off to first class, 6-star hotel, $1,000 to spend in the shops every day each?
Yeah.
You probably wouldn't sleep that night. You couldn't wait. Please, earlier. Now, which is better? Going to Hawaii, first class, staying in a 6-star hotel with $1,000 to spend all day, or going to heaven? Which is better? Going to some heaven place, of course it's better. So next time the doctor says to you, your cancer is terminal, you've only got 2 weeks to go, say, can't you make it 1 week? I can't wait. And the night before you're about to die, when you have all your bags packed, say, yeah, come on, you'd be so excited, I'm going to die tomorrow, woohoo! Can't you see this and looking at things in a different way? People look at death in a really weird way. Instead of, yeah, only 2 weeks to go. Of course, you all know that story of the man who was here in San Francisco, or in Sacramento, who was told by his doctor he's only got 1 week to live. Terminal. And he said, "Look, doctor, I don't think I can pay your bill
within 1 week. Okay, I'll give you 2 weeks. This is his business after all.
But when we put that in a reasonable perspective, then we realize that we're not so afraid. We're not terrorized by death. Because that's the whole point of, these so-called death cults and terrorists. They just try to scare the hell out of you and make you afraid and disturb your normal way of life. And of course, if we do change our normal way of life, and if we do stop respecting one another, caring for one another, and always be suspicious of our neighbours, that is when terrorists have won. And I think I said earlier, any of you here in the United States, especially if you live in a nice house, how many of you have insurance, property insurance? Mm-hmm. How many of you have alarms to stop burglars coming into your house and stealing your goods? How many of you have to lock your doors, making sure everything is locked and the windows are secured at night time because you're afraid of burglars? How many of you have surveillance cameras in your house in case there are burglars? I'm sure that this place doesn't have any surveillance cameras because they want burglars to come in to leave something in the donation box. But somebody told me a wonderful way of cutting off all of that fear of burglars. If you do live in a big house here in the United States, and if you pay too much for insurance in case burglars come in, the solution is get a flagpole. Don't put a US flag on the top of the flagpole. Put an ISIL flag on the top of the flagpole. And then you will get 24/7 surveillance by the CIA, the federal police, the state police, all for no cost to you at all. They will take care of your property for you. Now, there's an interesting point here, is whenever we have any problem, you can always see a funny side of it. And that is one of the beautiful parts of modern culture, the beautiful sense of humour which we have. And that sense of humour is something which is the opposite of what terrorism wants to inculcate in people. They would inculcate fear, mistrust, taking away your happiness, taking away your lifestyle. You don't have to do that. And one of the other ways is, where does this all come from anyway? Now, I'm doing my bit to stop terrorism, especially Islamic terrorism, because you know what I've been doing over the last few years? All of my books have been translated in Bahasa, Indonesian. Mm. You may know that Indonesian has the largest Muslim population in the world. Mm-hmm. Huge number, more than anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And so, when my books are translated into Indonesian, you can see these stories which I tell. Now, they aren't sort of particularly religious, so much so that, that first book which I wrote, The Truckload of Dung book, I got a call from evangelical Christian in the south of Australia. And he said, are you Ajahn Brahm? I said, yes. He said, wonderful book of yours. Would you mind if I use these stories in my sermons when I go around converting people to Christianity? And I actually said yes, because I knew the stories. They weren't converting people to one particular religion. They were converting people to being good, kind people. So the stories aren't particularly religious, which is why when I started printing them in Indonesia, they literally did become bestsellers. And I've got a photo somewhere in my monastery. Somebody went to the bookshops there, just like Barnes & Noble, or what's the other big bookseller? Sorry? Yeah, Barnes & Noble, the other big bookseller chains in the United States. Borders, that's right. But the big bookseller in Indonesia is a chain called Gramedia. Now, and these have got all the bookshops, for the Muslims and the others for minorities in Indonesia. And somebody took this amazing photo that they had all the books in line there, the 10 bestsellers. And I was number one bestseller, and number two was Harry Potter. I'm so proud of that.
But it wasn't just, you know, this pride. Because what I realized is that book was actually getting in, you know, not just to the Buddhist community, but the Muslim community as well. So when I give talks in Indonesia, Bante, there's half the people in the back there, in the front there, they've got veils on. We've got the imam sitting in the front. And we have the pictures of me with the Muslim leaders, arm in arm. And that's a beautiful symbol there, you know, to actually to get that friendship, you know, by teaching Buddhism, the Dharma, in a way which is acceptable to everybody. Because it does not matter what race, religion, sexual orientation you are. Once you see this Dharma, it's so beautiful, it makes so much sense, it's practical. And that gets people to respect other religions. And that is my aim. Because when people respect one another, there's no way they can kill one another. It's education. But that education is not going through the schools. No, people can stop that. It's going subversive education. That's why the YouTube is really good too. Because YouTube, no one can stop that. And again, the other thing, the last 2 weeks ago, Bante, when I gave a talk over in Western Australia, people were asking questions online from Syria. And Syria, this is a Muslim country, there's some Christians there as well, which is the center of the, you know, Islamic insurgency, the ISIS. And they were asking nice questions about, you know, how to deal with things. So when you actually preach and give a good talk and it goes on YouTube, it goes everywhere. Even I got an email back from a lady who lives over in New Mexico, and she said some of the talks, you know, solved many of her problems, but she got onto the talks on YouTube and a radio program, I think on National Public Radio. So interviewing one of the writers of Saturday Night Live. You know, Saturday Night Live, the most famous comedy show in the United States. And said, one of the writers, he had a problem when he listened to my talks, and that solved his problems. And when I read on the email that the writers of Saturday Night Live were listening to my talks, now I know where they got all their jokes from. So it's great when you get into the culture. Because one of the problems with Buddhism, Bhante, is sometimes it gets to the Sri Lankans, the Thais, you know, the people already Buddhists. Sometimes it gets to the professors in universities. But does it really get underneath and right into the society, into the kids? Know, into the people who are not Buddhist, into the mainstream, you know, of American society. When it starts getting into the mainstream of American society, that's when it really gets some traction. And we can do something really, really good in our world. In my job, in my position now, sometimes you do meet world leaders. And with one of the first world leaders I met, he was we call him the premier of the state of Western Australia. Similar to the governor of a state in the United States. He was the head of the executive government in the state of Western Australia, which had a big economy, huge state, bigger than Texas, and had a lot of mineral wealth. And he was the head of this state. But he was also the best man at Tony Blair's wedding. So he was a really close friend, you know, of Tony Blair. And he was almost my disciple, and I had my plan to change the world. Because I already had, you know, Tony Blair's best man on side, and I was just working from Tony, from this Jeff Gallup, the Premier of Western Australia, I was going to convert Tony Blair, and from Tony Blair to George W. Bush. Because they were really close together. And from there, I would save the whole world. Unfortunately, my plan came unstuck. It was close. But one of the things I got from some of these leaders, which is interesting for each one of you to know, is that they told me they were very at their wit's end trying to solve the problems of the world. They tried everything they know, and it wasn't working. Whether it's economy, or harmony, getting sort of Republicans and Democrats to work together, you know, getting sort of religions to understand one another. The whole world was so out of their control.
They were desperate for some new ideas. And that's why one of them told me, so we've never really explored Buddhism before. And all the psychology and conflict resolution techniques and other stuff which the Dhamma has. Please help us. Which is one of the reasons when I heard that, you know, for world leaders, you realize, you know, this subject we can really help. Not looking to convert the world to being Buddhist, although I did say to Bhante earlier, my goal in life is to convert the Pope. Once I convert the Pope, because he's infallible, then I already get one or two brilliant Catholics and it's all in one shot. Convert him, and everyone else has to come. We've got this wonderful center in the middle of Rome, the Vatican. So that's my job. And once I've come out, that you have no trouble of getting a temple over here. I'll look after you. But no, seriously, you're not out to convert anybody, but you are out actually to give some good input into how to actually to solve some of these problems in this world. And again, how to actually to solve mistrust. How do we solve mistrust? You can see that mistrust even in your family. How many of you have had arguments with somebody in your family and even don't even talk to them? How many of you mistrust people in your workplace? And so if you can't actually solve these problems first, find out how they work, then afterwards we can actually take those to the next level and actually create a different system. Now, one thing we should do, you know, you're all supposed to live in a democratic country. You know, there's a few flaws in the democratic system of the United States, quite a few flaws. And because, you know, I know my history, you know, we have, for example, your Senate. You know, the senators, the word Senate comes from the ancient Roman system of government, which was, for many years, a democracy. And someone who stood for the Senate in Rome, you know, centuries ago, was called a candidate. This is where the word candidate comes from. You know where that, what that word really means? In Latin, because I studied Latin at school, a candidate means someone who wears white. Because the system was that when anybody was standing for the Senate in Rome, they would wear white clothes as a symbol of their purity, of their virtue, of their past conduct. And in those days, people were elected not on what they promised to do for you in the next 4 years. They were elected on what they had done in the past, on their past record rather than their future promises. Now you can see what a difference that would make. Now, just now, in the United States, if now on the debates we wouldn't listen to what they said they were going to do for the country, or the economy, or for security, but we investigated what they had done in the past, their past record, and made the election just on that. Because quite frankly, all politicians lie. One of my favourite little jokes is the three people being interviewed, you know, for standing for Congress. They had to go to the panel of elders in the party to be interviewed before they were selected as a candidate. And so the last three came in to be interviewed. The first one went in there, and all the grandees of the party said, "This is the last question. You know, the person who gets the best answer will be our candidate for Congress in the next elections. Very simple question. What is 2 + 2? And the first candidate got out his usurped calculator, put it in and said 4. Very good. Asked the next candidate to come in. Same question, what's 2 + 2? He didn't need a computer, he said 4 straight away. Asked the next candidate, what's 2 + 2? And the candidate said, "Whatever you tell me, it is, boss." You're the candidate. And you can see sometimes that's what politics does to us. You know, we just do what we're told. and we make promises. I never blame any politician for breaking promises. I blame them for making those promises in the first place. How can you promise, knowing, as Buddhists do, that the future is uncertain? Anicca, you don't know what's going to happen next week. How the economy is going to go, how the weather's going to go, the disasters, natural disasters and other things which no one can predict. So how can politicians make promises? Wouldn't it be wonderful if they understood the Dhamma and know the future is so uncertain you can't make promises, but you can have a good record of dealing with problems in the past. So yeah, this person may be able to be the one to help solve problems. And number two, why is it that people argue with each other? Democrats and Republicans, doesn't matter, you know. Because I saw this little program somebody showed me, Anderson Cooper on, is it 60 Minutes? Or whatever. It was on mindfulness meditation.
Yeah.
And there was one of the politicians, I think it was Jack Ryan, he was very much into mindfulness, which means meditation in code. That's code, okay, for meditation. But if you call it meditation, as many people say, that's too religious in Congress. But he was trying to teach meditation in Congress, calling it mindfulness. And I think Anderson Cooper asked him, he said, "Now you're a Democrat. Any Republicans doing this program?" He said, "No, because I started it. I'm a Democrat." Why do you do such things? Just because a Democrat sort of suggests it, if it's good, why can't Republicans do it? No, they can't, on principle. And that really made me laugh. Why do we do such things? Now, finding the solution for that, I'm going to go back to your daily lives, to marriage. How many people argue in marriage, in a relationship? They're always arguing with one another, and that's really difficult. Oh, we have a priest coming here. Okay, I better stop the Christian jokes. Okay, so, all these people who get married, they always complain about people arguing. Remember this man said, hello, this man said, oh, you know, when I was looking for a wife, I wanted to marry Mrs. Wright, and I did actually marry Mrs. Wright. You know what Mrs. Wright means? My wife is always right. That's what Mrs. Wright is. So isn't it really sort of fair when your partner's always right? Please come and sit down. Take a seat. Very good. Hi. In the back. Hi. Welcome. You haven't missed very much. Only a few bad jokes. Very good. So, I mean, I'm sure you can use this as well. Very good. In marriages, people are always arguing in a marriage. Now, many of you have heard, you know, read on the Dung book about, you know, the chicken and the duck story. This is even better than the chicken and the duck story. Because there was a couple. It was actually a German couple. They were always arguing with each other. And for the first 2 or 3 years of marriage, it was very, very difficult. She thought she was right. He thought he was right. And neither side could give in. And so they decided on a very simple method of solving all of the problems, but making it fair. They used what we call in marriage these days, the calendar method. And the calendar method works like this. If it's an odd day of the month, she is right. If it's an even day of the month, he is right. So it works out fair. So instead of having an argument and trying to prove who is right, which is endless, and you get so much bad feeling inside of you having argued with a person you love in front of your kids, and that really, really disturbs the children as well. Instead, you have a difference of opinion. Look at the calendar. If it's an odd day of the month, she's right. An even day of the month, he's right. Which means you're both right even number of times. You don't need to go and spend all that money on a counsellor. Instead, you can give all the money you spend on a counsellor to this month's temple. If it's your congregation, to your church, it makes life much easier, and it's fair. Now, people think that's a joke, but actually it works. People have tried that. Because, look, trying to argue and prove who's right and who's wrong, isn't that endless? It's totally endless. So instead, just use the calendar method. You know, you look up, have an argument. What day is it today, Venerable?
19th.
So today, she is right. Be careful, because tomorrow, he's right. No, there's no argument. So, from marriage, I want to transfer that to Congress. On the odd days, then the Democrats are right. On the even days, the Republicans are right. That will save a lot of your taxpayer dollars. Gridlock will be ended, and you get many more things done. But why is it that we argue so much? And when we argue so much, we get this terrible bad feeling towards one another. We get resentment. There's nothing worse than being, you know, having this beautiful, terrible feeling with someone who is a friend, your brother, your wife. You feel terrible inside. You've argued with someone you care about and love. It's best to try and stop the arguments before they start. If we just look at the calendar, and you know, basically, it's much better living in harmony than being right. Now, even if you know you're right and she's really wrong, you know that. I know she's wrong, but even day of the month, odd day of the month, she's right. It doesn't matter. It's better that you don't have an argument. At least that night, you'll have a hot dinner. You might even have some sex. Otherwise, forget it. You have to go and get takeaway. But it's much better having harmony in this world than being right. So now when we're talking about religions, why is it, you know, to end of all this argument between religions, that causes so much problems. Who's right and who's wrong? You know what the Buddha said? Whoever argues, they're the ones who are wrong. The ones who agree and work in harmony, they're the ones who are right. It's a beautiful, wonderful teaching. Why can't we learn how to live together? And of course, you know, the story about harmony, which we have, and which I'm sure that you know as well, the story of the elephant. You know the elephant story? Now, you've heard the elephant story before, so you always have to change the story slightly. So, the kangaroo. Because I come from Australia. How many of you have ever seen a kangaroo? Only a few of you, maybe not many. Suppose you've never seen a kangaroo before. Suppose, as they say this simile, please take notice. Suppose you are blind since you were born. And you hear kangaroo, you know, what is a kangaroo? You've never seen one before. So they take 7 blind men and they take them to a kangaroo and they have to feel the kangaroo. And one of them feels the head, you know, with the ears. And one of them feels the paws. One of them feels, you know, the baby in the tummy. The other one feels the legs. One feels the tail. And they ask all these blind men, what is a kangaroo? And that first one who felt the ears, because ears of a kangaroo, they turn around and they independently turn around. So one can turn one way, the other one can turn another way. Now, they're, you know, two separate systems in the brain. That means they can actually protect themselves. They can sound over here and a sound somewhere else. They can hear both at the same time. Now, just like your husband, he can hear the TV when the cricket's on. He can also hear you. At least he pretends to. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have 2 independent ears, guys? Then you wouldn't need me later. Yeah. Darling, I am listening to you, but I'm also listening to the telly as well. But anyway, so he said, it's like a radar. And what about the one who feels the hands? It's, what is that? You know, like a boomerang. The tail, you know, it's always a snake. And they've got the head here. It's the only animal in the world which has 2 heads. The two-headed animal. Because the little kangaroos have a little baby in here. And have a big head at the top. Big head at the top and little head in the middle over here. So they, but what happens, you know, in that story is when they come back together again and say, what is a kangaroo? What is a kangaroo? They say, a kangaroo is 2 heads. No, it's not got 2 heads. It's got boomerangs.
No, it's not got boomerangs, it's a snake in the back. No, it's like this, it's like that. They all argue because everyone has only felt one part of the kangaroo. Just like Christians have got one part, Buddhists have got another part, Muslims have got another part, we've all got another part. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we all come together? And that way we can have some harmony. Now, this is, now because you're in front here, this is one of the stories which I love telling. Because I was giving a seminar, a chaplaincy seminar, in our local university in Perth, together with one of my best friends, who was a, he was the abbot of the local Catholic monastery, Benedictine monastery. There's only two monasteries in the part of Australia where I live, so he was the only abbot I knew. So we'd meet together and talk about abbot problems. And we were really close friends. And so we were having, actually, that when he died about 2 or 3 years ago. And you know, he was a Catholic, I was a Buddhist, and I was invited to his mass, his funeral mass. And I was the only non-Catholic in the whole church. And they invited me to speak. Because, you know, he was a good friend. They knew he was a good friend and how much we were close together. So a Buddhist monk gave a little speech at a Catholic Mass. And I was so honoured with that. That felt so wonderful, the way forward in our modern world. But anyway, before he died, we were having a presentation together at a conference. And in the back, there was a person who was very well known in Australia. And his actual name was, you won't know him, is Father Frank Brennan. Because he was an intellectual, very well known on TV. And he was a person, the Australian government, so selected to lead a panel to get a human rights constitution, no, in part of the Australian constitution. The Australian government doesn't have a charter of human rights. No, the constitution was made a long time ago and they left that out. And many people wanted to have a human rights charter within the constitution, and he was the one selected to lead the panel, you know, for this particular endeavour. So he was a very, very sharp person. So when he stood up and asked me a question, his question was, what is a Buddhist understanding of God? And I'm saying this because of you two over here. So what is a Buddhist understanding of God? You know, and this goes for Catholics, Jews, Muslims. Now, there's many ways you can answer that question. But the way I answer this question is a way which creates some harmony between religions and takes the debate a little bit deeper, a little bit further than just saying, oh, we don't believe in this and you believe in that. That creates conflict. So what I did, I said, my friend next to me, the abbot of this Catholic monastery, he's been saying something, one of his core beliefs, which he's been telling me for years. He said, in his opinion, everybody is searching for God. That's what he said. Now I said, Buddhists, what do we search for? I'm not going to deny my friends, because no, he really believes this, and I respect him. So what do Buddhists search for? What do you search for? What do I search for? What do all you in front of me search for? Well, you search for respect, no matter what race, gender, what age you are, respect. Search for love, to be able to receive and give love. You search for truth, for peace. We work so hard trying to find peace, sometimes we don't find it. And for harmony, for fun too. Fun? That's what we search for. So why don't we call that God? What everyone searches for. Respect. Truth, kindness, love, fun. And when we say that, then straight away there's no conflict between our major religions. There can be harmony. I can vote for that, the search for truth, for respect, for love, for peace, for freedom. Now when we say that, it's like a message which takes away the walls and barriers between all peoples and all races and all religions. It's a way we can create a better world, a harmonious world. How each one of us understands
the journey to find peace, to find freedom, to find respect. We'll find that out for ourselves. But when we have that as our goal, to respect each other's religions, races, age, sexual orientations, whatever, cultures, customs, then we can find a peaceful, happy world. So, I know I saw on your banknotes, in God we trust. I know in your Senate, do they do a prayer before? I think they do a prayer every time. Wouldn't it be wonderful if, instead of saying, please excuse me, God, in harmony we trust, in respect we trust, in freedom we trust, in love we trust. Wouldn't that be a wonderful prayer for the beginning of a Senate meeting or a Congress meeting? Because what that does, it solves some of the problems we face in our modern world. Sometimes people are at their wits' end. There's a lot of people have given up hope. They think, I started the talk off with terrorism in our modern world. How can you deal with that? So a lot of time people have given up hope. They think it's impossible. It won't work anymore. But now I've lived long enough, you've lived long enough, to see change. To see people who hated each other work together, respect one another. Change does happen. Never fast enough, slowly, but work for that. And of course, as human beings, we're always in it for the long haul. Bhante here is planted a Bodhi tree, the sacred tree of Buddhists, in the back. I don't think you'll be alive when you see a big. It may make 20, 30, 40 years before it really grows big. But it's worth doing. Many trees which you've seen, in the parks and the gardens. Because I'm English, I remember going to teach a retreat in a part of England called the New Forest. Now when they say new in Europe, sometimes it means 400, 500 years old. Because any of you know your European history, the Brits and the Spanish were always at war with, you're from Colombia, your ancestors and my ancestors, we were always fighting. Spanish and the English always stealing from each other, fighting. And this big forest just north of Southampton, which was a main port, that's where all the ships used to sail from, it's the head of the British Navy in Southampton, just north of there, this huge forest, which the Brits all cut down, they clear felled it to make the ships to fight the Spanish. But after clearing it, hundreds of square miles of forest were cleared. They planted a new forest. And that's why it's called a New Forest. And when you go there, it's such a beautiful forest, it looks no different than an ancient natural forest. It's come back again. And when I went there, I was so inspired to see, yes, Earth can be fixed. Yes. Divisions between religions can be fixed. Maybe not in our lifetime, but Buddhists, we all believe in reincarnation, so we'll be back here again to enjoy the results. So you have to make sure that you really work hard, not to make a world which is peaceful in your lifetime, but to make a world which is more peaceful, more harmonious, to solve these problems, maybe not in our lifetime, but certainly later on, for your kids. You want to see that forest, other people will. That's why it's worthwhile doing. So this is actually how we can actually use some of the wisdom, some of the conflict resolution, some of the bigger picture ideas to solve these little problems in this world. But with that story about the feeding the kangaroo, the original story is feeding different parts of the elephant. And you all know that story, I hope. But you know about the seven blind elephants. One through seven, it's a joke coming. Once there were seven blind elephants, and they were always wondering what a man was. They heard about a man, they never obviously seen one because they were blind. And so they heard the other story, and they thought, we know how to find out what a man is. We'll all go separate ways. We'll find a man. We'll feel that man. We'll come back and compare notes to what a man is. So they all went off to feel a man. When they came back, they all agreed that the man was flat. That's the only way that ever could feel something was watching it. You know, I told that to the Australian Prime Minister once, so he started to appreciate Buddhism a bit more. This is great when we need to have a sense of humour, because I'm sure God has a sense of humour and laughing. And just what laughter does actually brings us together. Because I've often noticed when people are different ideas, someone tells a joke, and everyone laughs. And when you laugh, you always laugh together. It brings this beautiful harmony together and happiness together, which is one of the reasons I tell jokes in my talks. So this is some little information on how we can allow people to overcome these terrible splits in society. And it's a great pleasure to invite people of different faiths, different religions, different genders, different races, different countries, different everything, to always to come together as often as possible. Because when we come together, now, I was very lucky when I grew up because my parents were very poor. There's a lot of benefits from poverty. Because I lived in a part of London which was full of migrants. I never realised until later that areas which had lots of migrants are the poor areas. So I had lots of migrants, and you know, in Britain we don't play sort of American football, we play soccer with a round ball. And quite frankly, I didn't mind what religion, what race you were, what colour you were, as long as you were good at soccer, you were in my team. And so he used to play with all sorts of people. Now, one of my best friends was from Jamaica. There was another friend who was from Sri Lanka. You know, his parents came there, and from Poland, and goodness knows where else from the world. And because you grew up together, you got into trouble together. Mm-hmm. I remember getting into trouble with my Jamaican fellow, Louis Neville, I still remember his name. And we got into trouble together because, actually, this is an old story, one of my stories, that we heard that there was a tunnel built many years ago from the local church to the local pub. I don't know why this was. But when we read in the paper about this, we decided, only 11 years of age, to go and explore it. And my mate Louis, you know, he told his mother, and we got into big trouble because of that. No, you can't go into the church at night and go into that tunnel. It's all closed off. But remember that, always getting into trouble together. But these were your friends. You go out together, and we're friends for life. That's a beautiful thing, to grow up with people of different races and religions, play soccer together or football together, get into trouble together, and make bonds which go across races, religions, so our world can be in a better place. I really would hope that our schools could be so mixed up, Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, atheists, whoever it is, mix them all up so that we make lots of friends across all boundaries. So please excuse me, I don't like religious schools. And I, because I'm a leader in Australia, I really stood up and said no Buddhist schools in Australia. And no art yet. I hope there never will be. Because I want people of all religions, all races. You know, no segregation, race, religion, economic bracket. Let everybody work together, grow up together, get into trouble together, be friends together, and that way we can have a harmonious world. Okay, question time. He told me to shut up. So I will. So thank you for listening. Question time now. Okay, any questions? Yes.
According to your math, you're saying that Democratic women would be right most of the time because they're usually 31 days.
Exactly. But just giving women a couple of extra days, it's worth it. A bit of peace and harmony in your life. In a leap year, you get an extra day. Okay. Yeah, so.
do have a question.
Yes.
I would like to know, I don't know if there's a real answer to this or this is even relevant, but can Buddhism be called a philosophy or a religion? Is there a difference there?
Yeah, okay. Well, in Australia, I was asked this on radio once, and I said, well, Buddhism is a religion for tax purposes anyway. If you're running a temple, you've got to worry about all the donations coming in. When you get some tax benefits from it, then Buddhism is a religion. Yeah, it's a religion, it's a way of life, it's a philosophy, it's a psychology. It's a way of understanding the world and yourself and your relationship within it. It has lots of beautiful gems inside of it. But it should never be used to separate you from somebody else.
But would calling the religion separate us from others?
No, not really. I mean, you're a woman, I'm a man, that's not going to separate us. You know, sometimes it's just a path, you know, a Democrat, you're an independent or whatever. You know, you're always going to have those leanings, you know, what you really like. What's really important is because what you like, you don't demean another person. Because harmony is really important in our world. Yeah, we argue together. You know, one thing I learned as a young man, before I became a monk, I had great arguments with my friends. Please excuse me, usually it was in the pub, you know, your bars. Went into a bar, you know, you'd have great arguments with your friend, but we had a rule. Whoever won the argument had to buy the next round of drinks for everybody. And afterwards, we were all friends. Because, you know, it's okay to argue. Because debates is where we can take the truth further. And when we have the arguments and debates, but with no ill will. So, okay, these days, obviously, because I'm a Buddhist, we don't have alcohol. So, you know, after whoever wins the argument takes them out for dinner. That's a nice thing to do.
So it is right to say at certain times that it could be religion?
Yeah, certainly.
You can say it's a philosophy.
Yeah, certainly. You can say it's a religion, you can say it's a philosophy. If you do get captured by ISIS forces, you say it's a philosophy, okay? Philosophy.
Okay,
yeah, go on.
Yeah, nice to meet you. Thank you. I've watched your talks for many years.
YouTube, yeah.
You know, within the last year, you've been getting weaker and weaker.
Yeah.
And it's been pretty difficult lately taking care of him. And I mean, I've been to a couple of Goenka retreats and I feel a little bit more calm about everything, obviously, right? But I see, like, my mom, she has a hard time, you know, helping and taking care of him. And I try to relieve the pressure off, and you know, I keep it light. But sometimes I get frustrated. You know, I know it's normal, I'm human. But you know, he needs care with everything. We can't leave him alone. And you know, as a son, I try to do my best, and I always like try to send him metta, and also myself, because you know, I don't necessarily like you know, especially like when I say something and I.
How to deal with this is a little story. This was in the Dumb Book about the seven monks meditating in a cave. You know that story?
I do not.
Okay, I would do it. It's worthwhile telling this story because it brings out what the real problem is to your question. This is an old story. Seven monks were meditating in a cave, and they meditated on love meditation, metta meditation. May all beings be happy and well, free of suffering. You know, you've done that before. Yeah. And so the seven monks were these monks. Now listen carefully, because I'm going to ask you a question. The seven monks was the head monk, and his brother was number two. And the third monk was his best friend. They'd all ordained as monks together. And the fourth monk, they called him the enemy. Even though they were monks together, you just don't get on. You know, in all religions, sometimes you get personality conflicts. I'm sure there's members of your church, you know, you love them, but they're hard to deal with. Yeah. So the fourth monk was the enemy. The fifth monk was a very old monk. He was so old, he could die any day. And the next monk was a very sick monk. And his sickness was so advanced that they didn't know who would die first, the old monk or the sick monk. And the last monk was what we call the useless monk. Whenever he tried to meditate, he fell asleep and snored. Whenever he did the chanting, it was always out of tune. He always forgot things. And I always say that every temple has one. And so those were the seven monks meditating on loving kindness in the cave in the jungle. And one day, a band of thieves found that cave in the temple. They wanted to take it over as their hideout, you know, where they could store all their stolen goods and they could stay until the heat was off, until the police stopped looking for them. It's a brilliant place in the jungle. But of course, you know, they had to kill all of the monks, because if one monk told the police, then they would all get caught. So that was what they planned to do, kill all the monks. Now, the head monk was a very good talker. You know, he could stand for Congress. And he managed to convince the people to let all the monks go except for one. One would have to be killed as a warning for all the other monks who were set free, that if they told anybody, these thieves would catch them and kill them. And that was the best the head monk could do. So he had this terrible, terrible choice of who would be killed so all the rest could go free. Now, I'm going to ask you who was chosen, but I'm going to tell you who the seven monks were again. If you read this story or remember it, please be quiet. So the seven monks again. The head monk, his brother, best friend, his enemy, he didn't really like him anyway, was causing trouble. The next monk was an old monk who was going to die anyway, a day or two. The next monk, a very sick monk, and he could always die. And the last one was a useless monk throughout his whole life had never done anything for anybody. So if you were that head monk, who would you choose? Himself?
The head monk.
The head monk chose himself. Please excuse me, Reverend, but that's the wrong answer. I don't mean any disrespect. That's why I ask the question, because most people say he chose himself. And that's the wrong answer. The reason is because his love towards his brother was exactly the same, no more, no less, than his love towards his best friend. He loved the enemy as much, the old man, the sick man, the useless man. He loved everybody exactly the same. And he even loved himself no more, no less than everybody else. Remember what Jesus said, to love your neighbor as yourself? Not more than yourself, not less than yourself, as yourself, which means love your neighbor. Love yourself as your neighbor. Love your neighbor as yourself. Now this is something in our Western world we keep forgetting. We love others more than ourselves, not as ourselves. So when you're looking after your father, don't forget to love yourself as much as your father. Love your father as much as yourself. Which means there are times when you need to take a break. Mm-hmm. So don't always be a person who sacrifices, especially in your position, because you get burnt out. You know, you'll be serving and helping others so much in your career that you get so tired and you get sick. You can't help anybody. So don't forget to love yourself no more, no less than the person sitting next to you. Equally. That sort of answers your question.
Yes, thank you.
Very good. Okay, yeah.
I'm a teacher and son of this fellow joke. I don't know if you find useful. I just wanted to offer this.
Okay.
Do you know how the Buddha orders a hamburger? Make me one with everything.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. You know how schizophrenic? Oh, I should really say this, but the old days, schizophrenic was one with a dual personality. They want to become two with everything.
Okay.
Could you call Shirley? She wants to offer
something. Shirley, you want to offer something? Okay, anyway, thank you for listening. I hope it was useful.
Yes, it was. Thank you.
Very good. Okay. What book is this? Okay, Michael.
So I can ask him to sign it for me. Already signed.
Oh. Are the kindness. Okay.
Oh.
For you. Very good. Okay. That is Shirley Kwok.
Shirley
Kwok. And she has been to Venerable's temple in Australia and studied under him for a while, and then she's living in San Francisco area, and we are very happy that she's the one who is organizing this tour. And it was very easy for us to work with her, and we say, can we send Achang for lunch here instead of 3 o'clock? And he said, okay, I check. And she called me back and said, can we ask him to give a talk again at 3 o'clock? Sure, but yeah, I think it is okay. And thank you very much, Shirley, for doing that, and that was a great help. Thank you, Venerable, for allowing her to make decisions like that, which is the right decision. And I'd like to thank Lal for driving Venerable for all these few days while he's in this area. Lal Sennaike is one of our good friends from San Jose area, and he's also a member of Santa Clara Buddhist Temple, Buddha Vihara. And I also like to thank Gamini and Kilita for having him for tonight, because our temple is not large enough and not comfortable enough for someone like him. So we
asked.
Yes. Actually, when we go somewhere, people ask us to stay at the temple, home, and nice home, than a temple. But technically, we always like to stay in the temple, even the temple is the smallest temple. But we want to make sure that he has a comfortable bed and comfortable bathroom and all that. So thank you, Gamini and Trilita. Can you stand up and for providing the yes. And who else? Venerable Sataloka. Venerable Sataloka is could not come here, but she will be coming soon. Probably we will see her at SBMG. And she's the one who is behind all these things. And Venerable Sataloka, you all know here, if you come to the temple, we have been friends with her way before she became a Buddhist Theravada nun. And she was very good friends with us. And she's the one who invited Venerable to come to the United States. And his one of the main goals is to help the nuns to improve their quality of life in America, because it's a very hard life for nuns, you know. But I'm glad all our members are always going there and helping them. Mahen, Dhammika, and all these people, course, from the
Diane family. And
yeah, right. And right, and Subhashini and all that, Mata. Thank you for going there. It's a long distance, but you help them a lot, as much as you can. And so that is that part. And Venerable Sataloka is not totally healthy, that is why she is not here. Otherwise, she will definitely be here, because she thinks that ABS Temple is one of her places, actually one of the important places for her, so since we are here together. And the other thing is, Mr. Wilson was introduced to us by one of our friends who is a member of our temple. And Mr. Wilson brought Bishop Richard
Rod Allen.
He is organizing a very important interfaith group in Sacramento, Northern California. And one day he came to a service with us, and monks are sitting on the cushion, and I thought he's a bishop, and he's a tall man, he's all the gentleman, and so it's nice to give him a chair. So far away in the corner, I gave him a chair, and he was sitting and listening to the talk on the chair, and we were sitting on the cushion, and he raised his hand, can I sit on the floor? That was very impressive. So he knew that he should be sitting on the floor in the temple, not on the chair. So, if Venerable is there,
He never give talks when somebody is sitting higher than him. That is not our custom. One day I went to SBMG and I said, a lot of people are sitting in the back and I'm sitting on the floor and giving the talk, and I said, this is something that we never do in Sri Lanka. And so one lady was sitting cross-legged on the chair, right in front of me. I finger point, and that is not the right thing to do. And she became one of the best members of our temple. Now she's helping her mother far away, so she doesn't come here. So anyway, I'm glad Mr. Wilson, you brought him and our family, I mean, all the other members for coming here. And everyone should be very grateful to Achang, not only me, because just to sit in front of him, listen to the same jokes that you have heard, but he tried not to repeat today. I was listening carefully. So it was very nice. And spending some time with someone like him, a Buddhist figure who is internationally well known and respected, it is nice for us, for all of us, all the young monks. Very inspirational, and I'm telling the young monks to listen to his talks and practice how to deliver Dhamma talks in English, you know. And I know some monks, young monks, who repeat exactly the same sermon that is given by him, and some people don't even know that this is Ajahn Brahm's Dhamma talk. But I still thank them for doing it, because they can repeat your talk nicely like that. It's good, huh? Yeah. So I think it's very nice. So it's a role model for a lot of young monks and all over the world, and so it's very nice. And we are so happy because we never planned Achang Brahm to be in our small temple in Boonies. We call it Sacramento. It's not San Francisco, not Los Angeles. You know, not New York, not Manhattan, but he's here, and we are so happy, and I'm especially grateful to the nuns for making all these arrangements. And also you should know that one part of his trip is to help the nuns financially somehow. I think when somebody signed this book, wisdom take a lot of money for sure, but some of that will go to the nuns. And so if you can buy a book in the evening, I don't know, we have the books here. Lal, you don't have the books, huh?
Not at the moment, but we can definitely get the books.
Here. Yeah, it was very nice. It's helping the nuns, helping Wisdom Publication, who's putting up Buddhist books all the time, and helping Venerable to give more Dharma talks. I don't know. You don't get any money, I know.
Okay,
too,
any,
not too much.
I saw hand to sign.
Yeah. And thank you all for coming. And thank you. We don't have enough words to thank Achang Brahm also, because his presence is priceless. And so thank you very much for coming.
You did have a question. Was it?
Oh, very simple.
Yeah.
First of all, I wish that every Christian could hear what you had to say.
There is no copyright. You can get that
copyright. I plan to do that, sir.
And I thought the question you were going to ask was what a lot of people ask. After that story about the monks in the cave, what happened next?
Well, we could talk about that, too, yeah. Sir, if you don't mind. But the question I want to ask is that we have embarked on a day of religion, day of peace. Mm-hmm. And what do you suggest? What is your wisdom on breaking down the barriers of what you said so true, that it's not about the ideology or theology, it's about humanity, it's about peace. How would you approach those that do not understand that philosophy, sir?
Maybe just have a football game, but practice it on religious grounds. A football game, okay? No, American football. So which means it has to be religious rules. If the other side want the ball, give it to them. If they can't score a goal, you score a goal for them. So have a little game. done by religious rules. Letting go, compassion, right? Not trying to be the best, but trying to even be a bit humble, trying to be the loser rather than the winner. But I like being a loser. I've lost so much in my life. And I've lost all my money. I've lost all my privileges. I'm a monk now. So losers are good. Losers have much more fun in life. So I'm just changing people's attitudes. So yeah, maybe just do something together. Stop just talking together. We've been talking for years and centuries. We end up just arguing. Do something more active. Play a football game. But now, not just Christians versus Buddhists or something. Have Christians and Buddhists on the same time, same side.
Mix it up.
Because a lot of people ask this question, I thought this was a question you're going to ask. Once that head monk told the thieves his answer, said, "I can't choose," what would happen next? And this is actually based on the Buddhist story of Thalaputta Thera in the Theragata. It's quite a bit different, but it's based on that. The thieves were so impressed with the answer that half the thieves, they gave up thieving, went back to the village, got a proper job, and the other half became monks. And so inspiration sometimes changes people's lives. So that's very good. Okay.
Thank you, sir. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Everyone, please put your palms together to the Bhavatu sabba mangalam rakkantu sabba devata sabba buddhanubhavena sada svatthi bhavantu te bhavatu sabba mangalam rakkantu sabba devata sabba dhammanubhavena sada svatthi bhavantu te bhavatu sabba mangalam rakkantu sabba devata sabba sanghanubhavena sada svatthi bhavantu te. Well, we have your room.